Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Caleb Mannin, continuing the reading of my 2015 novel, Bust It Like a Mule, The Tale of Cotton Kingfisher. Chapter 12. The tales of cotton, as long as the tracks across the states like train whistles in the wind, tell about how Cotton was a hard-ass worker on account of busting it like a mule, and he had worked mighty hard on the Tillamook Burn, and they had asked him to stay on as a government employee, but he had to get a move on, so he did. Cotton did not wander because he could not or would not keep a job. It was just that he felt himself being drug around, and sometimes he would stay a day, and sometimes a week, and sometimes a month. But in the end, he would always get a move on and light out like an ember from a fire that leaves the fire and up jumps into the sky, and then you can't see where it went. That was Cotton. There were times that he had no reason to leave, by God. He had every reason to stay. Like when he was young and in California and was a lifeguard and got to see all them beautiful girls and their wet delicates. But that jackass stubborn Cotton went and left that paradise. And when others that wandered the rails heard about him leaving that paradise, they wondered what had happened to make this man such a damn fool, though they were wanderers in spirit as well and probably would have done the same thing as he. That was why it was worth taking note of the fact that he wandered off the rails and went into the heart of Montana like that and set to get himself a job by God, and he did. Now, it was Saturday, and this must have been the reason nobody was missing that Terry kid, and the Forest Service didn't need Cotton's labor until Monday. But they set him up in a bunk cabin, and no one else was there, so he got himself all showered and shaved and cleaned up and tried to set his nose straight, but he knew that was about as good as it was gonna get. So he left it and combed his hair up nice and put on his crisp, new, green official uniform. One would think Cotton didn't cotton to uniforms, no pun intended, but he had worn them many times just to get by, and he always wore them as if they were a costume, like he has done in the circus once back in the day. And once he got his mind set on this mindset, he was all right with wearing them as long as for not too long. Besides that, work uniforms wasn't like suit and tie uniforms, for he would never wear a suit and tie uniform and work in tall buildings, by God. For Cotton figured if God would have wanted to make men wear suits, he would have killed a suit instead of a lion to cover up Daddy Adam and Mama Eve. But he didn't. He made them wear animal skins and made them go out and bust it like a mule, and this is what Cotton figures is right, and he does. So he went back into town looking slicker and snot in his brand new duds just to show the locals what for, by God. He went right on back to the goddamn dog leg, and the man Carl behind the counter, who was the owner and had seen the whole thing yesterday, says, "I think you need to leave, mister," after he gets over the shock that Cotton is wearing government green and is all cleaned up. And Cotton says, "It's a free country, ain't it? And sides, I work for the Forest Service now, so nuts to you." And that Carl owner turned kind of green-like Cotton's uniform, but he kept his mouth shut and gave Cotton a beer when he ordered it, so nuts to him. "Where's the girl?" Cotton asks, and the owner looks at Cotton like he's lost his damn mind and says, "Mister, please let it be, will you? We don't want any more trouble." And Cotton is wondering what trouble, because he didn't start nothing in the first place, by God. He sits and smokes his hand-rolled cigarettes and drinks beer at the bar, and no one bothers him while he thinks good thoughts about the girl switch-hipping, even though she ain't even there to see. And he thinks about just a few days back from then to now, which he usually don't, because he does not like to think of time in a straight line like a fishing line in the water, tight from a hooked gill, but more like a snarled fishing line that you chuck because it is wrecked. But he does think straight now, and he cannot fathom how much life has changed for the better in just a few short days, and usually this makes him want to get a move on, but now it don't, so he sits in his smoke and he remembers about how the smoke helps him pray. So he's smoking and drinking and poor man praying, and he drinks a lot of beer, though the man at the counter don't want to serve it to him none, but is too scared to refuse, and is confused as to how in the damnation Cotton got on at the Forest Service in the first place, for God's sakes. So Cotton is drinking a lot of beer, and he thinks about being a boy at the homestead like he does sometimes when he gets an empty feeling in his belly like there is now. And he gets mad at the hole in his stomach and he curses it, but what can a man do? Once a preacher told Cotton that he was wrestling with God like Jacob wrestled the angel, and this preacher said he walked with a limp in a spiritual-like way, like one who had wrestled an angel, and Cotton said, "Preacher, if I was wrestling God, I would hope he'd be big enough to beat me." And the preacher says, "He is." And Cotton laughs and says, "Well, he ain't beat me yet." And winks at the preacher, and the preacher did not like it one bit, no sir. So he prayed for Cotton after Cotton left. And if Cotton knew this, he would have been sore for a man praying at him like that. But what he don't know don't hurt him. Hell, in fact, it helped him, by God, as you will soon see. So he is sitting there in the dog leg thinking, and he thinks that there was a family Bible in the homestead wherein he was raised, and he wonders if it is underwater with his mama, and he gets angry, for his mama read the Bible, and it didn't do her a damn bit of good nor her children. Cotton had never cared for the Bible when he was young, for it told him to pray to God, like God was a good daddy. But Cotton did not know what a good daddy was, so he just prayed to God like he was a distant relative, and God still did not save him from his daddy or any other old thing, so what was the goddamn good? Cotton begun to think that he did not want to be covered in the blood of the lamb or any other for that matter. But what Cotton does not know is that he has been covered in his own blood and many others his whole life, through his vile temperament and violence, and each time was like a baptism of bad blood. Maybe, I don't know, and I don't want to be blaspheming God none, God help me. I am just saying what Cotton is thinking, good Lord, if you are listening. Cotton gets plumb wore out just sitting back on his thumb, thinking Christ thoughts and mama thoughts and Bible thoughts. So he gets up and pays his bill and gets the hell out of the dog leg. And outside it is dark as hell, but all the stars are shining like little Christmas lights that Cotton sees inside windows and on people's houses, but he has never owned any himself, and he cannot believe how grand all the stars in the big sky are, sparkling like angels' teeth and Christmas lights. He is standing there dumbfounded looking up at the stars when he hears someone call to him, and he thinks he is dreaming about his mama. But it ain't his mama, it is that girl, Jail, who brought him breakfast in jail, and he thinks he is dreaming, but he knows he ain't, but he says, "Am I dreaming?" Though he knows he ain't, and this sly, pretty girl says, "Do all your dreams have me in them?" And Cotton says, "I wish, by God." And she blushes a bit, but there is no harm done, 'cause no one can see her cheeks go red like a wildflower, for it is big sky dark out there. Then Cotton says, "What in the hell are you doing here?" And the jail girl, looking all pretty, even in the big dark, says, "I live here, Cotton, or have you forgotten? I came to tell you the police are looking for you to give you hell and make you leave. Carl just called them." And Cotton knows that Carl is the dog leg bar owner, and knows he will give Carl a piece of his mind. By his mind, he means a knuckle sandwich with extra sauce, the next time he sees him. But right now that little girl grabs his arm, and man, I will be damned. Her grip is firm and leads him down the big sky dark sidewalk and into a joint which, come to find out, it is a bowling alley, by God. Well lit and lots of families, and Cotton goes blind with the lights, and it is loud, and there are lots of children hollering and whatnot. By the time he can get his wits about him, he is in the bowling alley, and he says, "I can take care of myself, by God." Seeing as how the girl is trying to hide him from the cops, and he don't need no goddamn girl hiding him from no by God cops. JL smiles at him and says, "I bet you can, by God." And she is teasing him by using his favorite word, and he likes it, so he rubs his face kind of self-conscious like, because his nose is fighting crooked, and hell, it always has been. Jail pays money for them to have bowling shoes and a pitcher of beer, though Cotton says no woman will buy him nothing. Well, she does, and tells him to go to hell besides, and Cotton likes it, so he lets her. So Jail sits down at a table next to their bowling lane, and Cotton is bamboozled, like he don't know why the hell this girl is being so nice to a goddamn drifter like he, but not wanting to say such a thing to her for fear she won't be nice to him no more, so he just fills a mug with beer and swallows it whole. "You sure can drink," JL says, "but can you bowl?" And Cotton says, "Honey, I ain't met a girl who can best me yet." And JL proceeds to best him yet and whoop his ass in the first game and more. And he does not even give a damn, which ain't like him at all. He usually gets powerful angry over losing, hell, even more so to a girl. But for losing, Cotton pays for all the beer, and they are drinking mighty fine, and the families are covering their youngins' ears, because Cotton is cussing like a goddamn merchant marine, or maybe just a goddamn marine, but cursing something fierce anyhow, and JL don't seem to give a good goddamn, and she is laughing. Cotton is happy as a dead pig in the sunshine, though he feels silly-like in these goddamn bowling clown shoes that looks familiar from his days in the circus. With JL winning, for he gets to watch her from behind in her polka dot skirt as she bends to huck the ball down the glossy alley. And the hole in him that he was talking at earlier in the bar is gone for now, and there is just a jonesing for that big sky girl to come childbearing, switch-hipping on over here and sit on his lap and call him daddy, and he will call her his sweet booga honey, hot damn. Chapter 13. After a few rounds of bowling and beer, the drifter and the pretty girl sat at a table to smoke and drink more beer, and Cotton says, "Why are you so goddamn kind to me? I'm about to get suspicious." And JL just smiles and shrugs and says, "I think you're all right." And Cotton says, "I'll take it." And the girl goes on, "Those men were picking on you, and they deserved what they got when you beat them. Carl told me to give the money back that we won, but I said no, so he fired me." "Fired you, by God," Cotton says, and he is fiery furnace fit to be tied at Carl, the owner of the dog leg. For Carl is a worthless, no-good, son-of-a-bitch welcher that fires girls for winning a bet fair and square off a man who won a fight fair and square. "Don't get all riled up," JL says, and she waves her red fingernails in the air like she is swatting a fly, and Carl, the dogleg owner, is the fly, and goes on, "I don't give a damn. I can get another job. That place was a hellhole. That is one of the boys' tricks. They find strangers who don't know any better, and they lure them into fight. Then they beat them up and take their money." "Well, I guess I know why you bet on me then," Cotton says. "They picked the wrong SOB to mess with, I reckon." "I reckon so," smiles JL, and she is real pretty when she smiles like that under her black hair cut across her forehead, and when she teases Cotton, he reckons. "Next time, just try not to kill Terry and make the whole town mad is all. I guess he had it coming, and I don't pull any punches, by God." "No, you certainly do not. Where'd you learn to fight like that?" And just for a flash, Cotton's a mind to tell her on his early hobo bare-knuckle brawl boxing days, when he'd box for money in dark alleyways and seedy dockyards. Then Cotton can see this girl is starting to get him chewing the fat, and he's been drinking, and he will need to be careful about this one like Adam should have been careful with Eve, so he says, "Hell, I came out of the womb kicking." And JL thinks it's charming, but she don't bite the bait. And Cotton can see that though she appreciates his charm, she does not bite. And this is the first girl he thinks he's seen as such, and he thinks it's charming and he bites. Now, while JL and Cotton are sitting there bending each other's ears back, I was going to tell you how I was wondering why a man would sit at the fire and open up his palms to the fire when his palms is such a small part of him needing that fire. But a man always puts his palms nearest to the fire first, natural-like, like God made him do it. So I was at a fire, and I opened my palms to it, just like I said any man does, and it sent a great God warmth into my palms that shot all up in my body like a swig of whiskey. Then I knew why men do that, as palms are like metal to a magnet for the heat. I say this to talk about how a man is like this to a woman, and the man being the palms and the woman the fire. And man just naturally sidles on up and takes all the warmth of the woman she gives him, and it runs all through his body like a swig of whiskey. This just being the way the good Lord made it. And this is how it was with Cotton and that girl, Jail. She was warm and he was open palms, getting a dose of her fire that went all through his body like a swig of by God whiskey. This is why I told you that about the palms and the fire. The pretty fire and them rough palms sit and talk and smoke, and they do not say much about anything, though they talk a whole hell of a lot until the place shuts down. Then they stand on the sidewalk under the big sky stars, and the black feet wind is blowing, and Jail's teeth are gleaming in the night, and Cotton wants to give the girl a good hard kiss. But for some reason he don't. He don't even try. And he wonders why he don't even try, but he don't. And that is all there is to it, damn it. They say good night, and Jail says she had a good time, and she will see him around town. And when he hears this, he says, "Unless I see you first," trying to be all cute, but he knows it is just jackass beer talk, and it just slipped out like a jackass brain. And he is about to ramble on some more, and that would have just been more mule brain. But the girl is gone off down the sidewalk into the night with a laugh like a hoot owl in the dark. Cotton manages to drive the national park truck to the cabins he is staying at on a government dime without wrecking it all up, though he drank a hell ton of beer. And he goes and falls dead into a bunk and passes out thinking sweet thoughts of big sky round hips and glacier firm rising breasts and juicy ruby reds under a dot of a beauty mark. And as he drifts off to the big rock candy mountains, he thinks that that little girl Jail told him a story about the cops coming after him. She just told him that to get him to come with her bowling, and that is mighty fine for him, by God. Cotton gets up the next morning and finds Jail has slipped him a $20 bill from her fight winnings into the pocket of his work shirt, and it makes him angry as all hell. But not as angry as the fact that someone is in the cabin, John, when he tries to go see a man about a horse. So he goes outside and takes a leak on a great-grandfather pine, then realizes that there are people out there, tourists, by God, wandering on past the workers' cabins, rubbernecking at him, so he lights a cigarette with his fly undone and hollers at him, "Enjoying the show?" And he keeps on leaking, and the people googly-eyeing him get a move on, by God. When he goes back on in the bunkhouse, there is a man at the stove making what smells mighty good, and he does not turn when Cotton comes in, so Cotton says, "You must be the new guy." Just joking-like, for see, he is the new guy. And the man turns around for Cotton to see he is an Indian kid. And Cotton is happy to see this, though this Indian kid, he does not have long hair, nor feathers, nor native garb. Cotton is happy to see an Indian roommate besides, for he knows Indians are hell of firefighters, for he has worked with them hot-shot red hat crews from Navajo Rezes, and he knew some of them besides from the war. "Are you the new man?" the Indian asks, and Cotton says, "Yep, what's your name?" And the Indian says, "Jacob Two Calves." And as much as Cotton respects the Indian last name, he can't keep his mouth shut about the white bread Old Testament first, so he says, "Jacob, what kind of Indian name is that?" And the Indian turns back to the stove and is silent, and Cotton feels a bit foolish about offending a goddamn Indian about a by God name, but he can fix it, so he goes on, "When do we start?" And Jacob the Indian says, "It is Sunday. We start tomorrow." And Cotton says, "All right then, Jacob," on purpose calling him by his Christian name, so to speak, to make peace pipe about that name that Cotton made fun of. But the Indian don't say nothing, so Cotton sits on his bunk and thinks about Jail and smokes, and then the Indian hands him a plate of food for no goddamn reason. He does not even know him, and he made fun of his name to boot. And Cotton is much obliged, of course, and they eat in silence. And it is tasty beef steak, though Cotton wishes it was bison, but it ain't. And eggs and some sort of native mash or some such Indian meal, Cotton wagers. Cotton is fond of it, the mash, and he tells Indian Jacob so, and Jacob nods his thanks. Cotton is partial to all sorts of victuals, being that he is a well-traveled man and has a hollow leg, as his daddy would say, for he is fond of okra and beans and grits and sprouts and cabbage and tomatoes. as well as venison and mackerel cakes and pork and beef and mulligan stew and succotash and wild duck, rabbit, and grouse, and cornbread and biscuits, of course, and buckwheat pancakes with stewed peaches and candy bars and hamburgers and hot dogs and fried chicken and mashed taters and brown gravy on a slice of white bread or any type of shit on a shingle. And hand-rolled cigarettes, as well as beer and sweet tea and black coffee and hot sauce, as well as whiskey, as well as champagne. The only time Cotton ever drank the blonde bubbly was when a pretty little thing who was blonde and bubbly brought it for him. And he and this blonde bubbly girl got paint the town red-faced and had the time of their by-God lives before Cotton left her the very next morning, as soon as the fog in the air and his head lifted. For any girl that will bring you the blonde bubbly is playing for keeps, and Cotton wasn't a keeper, so he left. I told you all this just so you would have something to know about Cotton as he sits there in silence with his Indian, so you do not wonder what was happening, for nothing was and is. They are just sitting silent as they eat, for Indians are silent people, Cotton has come to find, a lot of them anyways. And he thinks it is best not to bother them, and this is awful polite of Cotton, as you might know. Chapter 14. Cotton and Jacob Two Calves sit and smoke Cotton's hand-rolled cigarettes, which Jacob seems to like a heap, after this hearty breakfast. And Jacob Two Calves is a mighty fine person, Cotton wagers, for he tells Cotton, after he warms to him a bit, all about how he is Blackfeet Confederation. But Blackfeet ain't even the half of it. For Blackfeet is a white name for a bunch of different tribes, by God. And Jacob is actually a blood Indian, which Cotton likes very much, for he likes the word blood. Jacob says he is from the res that borders the park and jumps clean on up into Canada. For white men have borders, but the Indians don't have white man borders. And Cotton likes the sound of all the Indians up here in the meaty part of Montana. Jacob goes on that he comes to work here at the park in the summer, and he loves this place for it is beautiful. And Cotton tells him about how he heard it is the land where the world began from Indian father down south. Then Jacob says it is so, and tells him about old man, and how he created the mountains, and the lakes, and the rivers, and streams, and animals, and even the first man and woman. And how he showed him about food and fire and even killing buffalo by running them off a cliff. And Cotton is thinking real heavy as Jacob Two Calves tells him all this, just slumping on his bunk, slow smoking. And life feels just about right, and he feels like the earth ain't out to get him, especially if old man made it. Where's old man now? Cotton asks, for he figures he ain't seen old man unless by the work of his hands in these here mountains. And he wonders if old man is the same Lord God from the Bible. And Jacob says, he is gone away, but he will come back and bring back the buffalo. And Cotton says, what happened to all the goddamn buffalo anyhow? I'd like me a bison steak. And Jacob Two Calves goes on about how the tribes of Indians were hit mighty hard by white men bringing smallpox and wiping the buffalo out. And Cotton figures that he is speaking with a real Indian like he has been looking for his whole life when he came out west, even though this kid does not have feathers in his hair nor native garb. Cotton likes the look of his face, for it is like a dark, polished leather laid upon stone, with warm brown eyes, and Cotton thinks Jacob must be young and old all at the same time as he speaks real plain about the Indians losing their old ways. Cotton thinks it makes the hole inside him ache just a touch to think about all them damn Indians losing their land and their happy hunting grounds, and even their buffalo, by God. And it aches a touch, just like it aches when he thinks about how he lost his land and his hunting grounds underwater with his mama, and he don't even know where his tribe is. He thinks as he smokes that he wonders why men always have to try to tame the wild wanderer, like he and the Injuns, and put up fences up on him, and he feels like he knows Jacob Two Calves better than he has known anyone else, like they are brothers. And he thinks this as their cigarette smoke rises up and drifts together till you can't tell whose smoke is whose, and that mixed up cloud of smoke drifts out the open cabin door and into the Blackfeet wind and into the Glacier Mountains where the world began. And Cotton imagines Old Man can smell their smoke and is smiling down upon them from the sun. And Cotton wonders when Old Man is coming on back to bring back the buffalo, for he could use a by God bison steak. That's all for tonight. You've been hearing my novel, Bust It Like a Mule. I'm Caleb Mannon, and have a heap of help from Mike Ailman and Vern Windham, who recorded and edited it. It is a production of Spokane Public Radio for The Bookshelf. Bust It Like a Mule is available on Amazon and Kindle. It is also at some libraries as well as major booksellers, including Auntie's, of course. Oh, and the author's front porch. For original music and more about the book, visit CalebMannon.com. Catch you next time. If you've missed any of the episodes, head over to kpbx.org to hear the podcast. If you're confused, check out episode 1. I've gotten a lot of rave rejections for my novel Bust It Like a Mule. Hell, I even put them on the back of the book. Even Vern was a little skeptical at first. If it hadn't have been for the legendary Nancy Roth, I don't know if you'd be hearing this right now. So thanks, Nancy.